Welcome to this episode of the AANS podcast. It's not brain surgery, the AANS practice and business management podcast. I'm Paul Camerata. I'll be your host for today's show. And today we are honored to have the chief of the Division of Pediatric Neurosurgery at UCSF and a professor in the departments of neurosurgery and pediatrics, Professor Nalin Gupta of the University of California, San Francisco. Professor, welcome. Nalin, thank you.
Thank you, Paul. Pleasure to be here.
So this is one of these episodes. Dr. Gupta is going to review some articles that you might have missed in the JNS Pediatrics. So, you know, your average neurosurgeon who may be skimming the journals and may have missed some articles. We've asked Alan to go through and pick out some articles from the last few issues of JNS Peds, articles of import and why they should be important to us. So why don't you kick it off, Nalin, with one of the articles that you've perused and brought to our attention?
Yeah, sure, Paul. So I actually selected a handful of articles, but I think the theme, if you will, of two or three of them is really the power of large consortia, or at least consortia of neurosurgeons studying rare diseases. And so one of the articles, which we can touch on very briefly, highlights the advantages of this approach. And this one is titled Temporal Trends in Surgical Procedures for Pediatric Hydrocephalus, an Analysis of the Hydrocephalus Clinical Research Network Core Data Project. And this is from the group of approximately 8 or 9 institutions that have been collecting data for almost 10 years now. And this is a descriptive paper, but I selected it because it gives us a high-level view of what is happening, in at least for pediatric neurosurgeons, which is a big part of our practice, which is hydrocephalus. So the lead author is Dr. Tember, but as I said, he's really writing this on behalf of the overall research group. So the cohort, as expected, is very large, 5,500 patients that received treatment for hydrocephalus, and they've tracked these patients over a period of time, and these patients have had about 10,000 procedures. So on average, wow, each patient has had 2 procedures each. But as I said, it's something that by looking at these patients over a longer period of time, they can look at not so much the granular what's happening to each patient, but what's happening over time. So just I pulled out a couple of important interesting pieces of data. One is that the overall procedure rates for hydrocephalus, which includes historically shunt placement, but also more recently the endoscopic procedures such as ETV and cord plexus cauterizations, the overall procedure rate is actually declining at about a rate of 1.5% per year. And that's very interesting. So, but if you look at the subgroups in terms of what surgeries they've been receiving, the shunt rate, so the placement of new shunts has been declining, whereas ETV rates have been increasing. And as you would predict with that, even if there are patients with ETVs who fail, those who have received ETVs and have had success with their ETV procedure has resulted in the aggregate revision rate for shunts actually decreasing at a rate of about 4.2% every year. So I pulled out just some of the key sort of pieces of information from this study because it tells us that in total, or if you look at sort of what we're doing, we're actually making progress in terms of things like repeat surgical rates and reducing the rates of surgery, which is a big driver of morbidity in this population of pediatric hydrocephalus.
So it tells us we're doing a better job, you think, than we were 15, 20 years ago?
I think so. Now, you could argue, like some of my adult colleagues would argue, we're starting at a point where we really need to improve, you know, what we're doing with hydrocephalus. But I don't think we would have gleaned that information without sort of looking at it in a fairly comprehensive way. So that's actually a good segue into, again, some of the advantages of having these prospectively collected data in a standardized fashion over a large number of institutions. And the second paper I wanted to talk to is also by the Hydrocephalus Clinical Research Network. And this is a specific question that was asked, which is the impact of ventricular size on neuropsychological outcomes in treated patients. And J. Reva Cambron is at the University of Calgary, is the lead author of this paper. And he wanted to ask a very specific question, which is that if you look at ventricular size as obviously we do that all the time when we look at patients who are potentially needing shunt revisions or presenting with hydrocephalus, does that actually have any impact in terms of cognitive function? And they were able to look at a subgroup within their data set that had had very detailed neuropsych testing. And they compared a group of patients who had ETV with those that had shunts. Now, what was interesting was that the overall ventricular size as measured by the ratio of frontal horn measurements on imaging studies. And you could argue that that's kind of an arbitrary measure, but at least as a surrogate of ventricular size, that ventricular size did not actually correlate with the outcomes with respect to neuropsych testing. Now, the caveat is that the level of detail that they did in terms of the neuropsych testing was only achievable in a very small group of patients, about 25. So it's clearly a limitation of this study, but they definitely pointed the way in terms of looking at patients both pre-op and post-op in terms of their cognitive function. And those kinds of outcomes, I think, are really important because in this field, we've focused on things like some of the surgical morbidity, but you know, these detailed outcomes in terms of how patients are actually functioning, are they returning to independent life? Are they in the normal school system? What is their performance scores? Those are the kinds of things that I think the HCRN and our field really need to be studying in much more detail.
Yeah, I have to say that I suppose this is this confirming what you may have thought or you had a hunch anecdotally, because you've undoubtedly seen patients with huge ventricles who cognitively look fairly similar to the rest of the population.
Yeah. I think, as I said, it's a small cohort, but I think that they made a comment in the paper that the obviously hydrocephalus is a heterogeneous diagnosis, and there may be, for example, kids that have had, you know, other injury, whether it be trauma, hemorrhage related to prematurity, that where if there's an overlapping or component of volume loss, then that may be the dominant factor in ultimately driving cognitive function and outcome, right, as opposed to simply ventricular size. And I think one of the reasons that ventricular size was looked at was that people who do ETVs for hydrocephalus, definitely the change in ventricular size from hydrocephalus following that is less than what you see with shunt placement. Yeah. But it seems that if patients are adequately treated with ETV, then that corresponding change in ventricular size or persistence of some ventricular megaly is not really a driving factor.
So talk to us about how our patients entered into the Hydrocephalus Clinical Research Network. Is this every patient that comes to one of these institutions with hydrocephalus on a scan, regardless of etiology, is entered into the data?
Yeah, so the HCRN actually started historically as just a small group of investigators who were interested in studying a relatively common disease. And they formed this consortium that established, and it's really been led by John Kessel at the University of Utah, but they started by essentially starting this registry. And the registry did not have a therapeutic sort of arm at all to it. It was simply recording all, you know, patient characteristics in a prospective fashion. And they've since expanded that from the core group of institutions to include a much larger number of institutions and increase, you know, because one of the criticisms is that can you generalize the results that are being discovered by this group across other institutions? So there's a registry that's obviously recording these data, but then the research group is also doing therapeutic studies now, in other words, and in fact, there's an ongoing NIH-funded randomized trial to compare ETV and choroid plexus cauterization versus shunt placement in terms of outcomes. And so that's a direct sort of, if you will, byproduct of the data that's come out of the HCRN that has led to and supported, I think, some really strong therapeutic studies. You know, and for just as a side note, I think, you know, we've historically had single institution, small cohort studies, and for some of these diseases that are difficult to study unless you have larger numbers, this is really going to be the way of the future.
Excellent. That's kind of what those who inaugurated it, I'm sure, had hoped for. What other articles have you culled for us to take a look at?
Yeah, so there was another article that it's another, and as I said, the theme is really larger consortia and groups working together. So this is a paper titled Extradural Decompression versus Duroplasty in a Chiari Malformation Type 1 with Syrinx, Outcomes in Scoliosis from the Park Reeves Sringo Myelia Research Consortium. So the lead author is Brooke Sadler, And this was a paper by this group, which was actually funded philanthropically, the Parks Reeves Consortium, not NIH funded. And what they've done is really looked also prospectively in terms of data collection of patients with Chiari, and in this subgroup, patients with Chiari and a syrinx who also had scoliosis. And the very specific question they looked at was, is there a difference if you do a standard decompression with duroplasty versus a bony decompression? And in this case, they had 422 patients in, with scoliosis and a syrinx and a Chiari. And then, not surprisingly, the majority, 346, had duroplasty. So, you know, a typical sort of what we consider as a typical procedure for a Chiari 1, but 50 had a bony decompression alone. So that is one downside of the registries, is you're not really truly, you know, randomizing.
Yeah, people are selecting, you know, which one they want to do.
Exactly. And they recognize that. They comment on that's clearly a limitation of these registries and recording it. You're not really correcting for some of the differences in it. Having said that, for example, amongst the two groups, the degree of scoliosis, age of onset, et cetera, was not different between the two. And what was interesting was that they looked at a fairly hard end, if you would, a hard endpoint or measure, which is how many patients ended up needing fusion. So fusion for their deformity.
Yeah.
Exactly. And so, you know, presumably people have different thresholds for that. But if you looked at the two groups, posterior fossa decompression with duroplasty or just bony decompression, there really wasn't different. The rates of fusion weren't significantly different between the two, which is interesting because, you know, certainly in my own practice, if I have patients with a Chiari, a significant scoliosis and a syrinx, I usually recommend bony decompression plus duroplasty for those patients. Now, there were small numbers, but the patients that had duroplasty were actually less likely to progress. And there were 7 patients in the posterior fossa decompression with duroplasty who actually improved in terms of their scoliosis. Hmm. Now, they had lower, you know, degree of deformity, but it wasn't observed in the 50 that only had bony decompression. But nonetheless, I think it really does, you know, at least point out that you have some options in terms of what to do with these patients, particularly if you're concerned at all about some of the morbidity that's associated with dural opening in these patients.
Was there a difference in syrinx size, or did they not specifically look at that?
No, they measured that, and they've both the diameter of the syrinx and extent of syrinx, and so across verbal levels, and there wasn't really a difference between the two groups did that. Now, the other things, of course, that are difficult looking back on it, the data elements that were recorded, there may have been differences between those groups that skewed it one way or the other, but there certainly wasn't a major difference in outcomes between the two.
Yeah, because I was, you know, I think, again, anecdotally thinking of my pediatric colleagues, I think they probably are more likely to do a duroplasty in someone with an extensive syrinx and scoliosis than they would be in a smaller,
exactly.
smaller
yeah,
syrinx.
My, same here. So
how about the other two articles?
Yeah, the other two, sir, this is a couple of other interesting articles. And one I highlighted only because I think it actually points out a big gap in our field. And so this is a paper titled Effects of Hypertonic Saline on Intracranial Pressure, Cerebral Autoregulation, Pediatric Traumatic Brain Injury. And lead author is Ziffel and a group in Germany, I think at Tübingen and Munich. And the reason I picked this article is that there's been a lot of money and research in TBI, Track TBI's consortia, et cetera, but really focused on the adult population. And certainly head trauma is such a major part of what we see also in young, you know, in the childhood population in detail, and even fewer that have looked at it in terms of some of the physiology that's happening in these patients. So the title of the paper was really, and the goal of it was to study the effect of hypertonic saline, in particular a 3% infusion of hypertonic saline. But I thought this paper was good because they really looked carefully at, and these were patients, I should say, all severe TBI, so GCS 8 or less. They had 28 patients. They all had escalated in sort of tiered therapy. And once they reached a certain point or threshold, if they have elevated ICP, then they received a treatment with hypertonic saline, and then they studied these patients in terms of both their favorable, so by Glasgow outcome scores, in terms of favorable and unfavorable outcomes. And of the two groups, they went back and looked at what were some of these physiologic measures that appeared to correlate with the favorable or unfavorable outcomes. And they actually had one of the measures, which I have not personally had experience, which is something they call PRX, which was really a correlation between mean arterial pressure and ICP. In other words, if you have a tight correlation between the two, it implies that there's a certain degree of autoregulation. And so what they did observe was that the patients that had a better or more pronounced response to hypertonic saline were the ones that were in the favorable group. You know, it's hard to connect all those dots, and it could be that we're seeing a reflection of injury, even though their Glasgow Coma score was similar. It could be that we're not able to parse out that level of detail. But I thought the strength of the paper was that they were able to look back at some of these physiologic endpoints and had studied them in sufficient detail that they could correlate it with their therapeutic intervention, which in this case was hypertonic saline, as opposed to mannitol or some other intervention. Yeah, so I thought, as I said, I think that, you know, this is the kind of work that I think we need to, as a group, need to really start doing in much more detail, because we just have very little information. Most of our guidance in terms of pediatric TBI is really derived from the adult literature, which may be appropriate, but may not be as well. So
it's good to begin having articles like this. And this one from Germany, you said?
That's correct, yes.
And the last article on sort of tethered cord syndrome. Talk about that one and what we learned from
that. Yeah, absolutely. So this is an interesting paper. It's titled Spinal Column Shortening for Secondary Tethered Cord Syndrome. And the lead author is McVeigh, and the senior author is Andrew Jay, who's a pediatric neurosurgeon, but has had a long history in spine procedures and in evaluating spine procedures. So the background is that children often with varying kinds of complex tethered cord, whether it be in the setting of spina bifida, myelomeningocele, or closed defects, will have surgery early in life. But if you look at those patients' imaging studies as they get older, in almost all situations, the distal spinal cord is scarred or attached to the overlying repair. Mm-hmm. And the theory and the theoretical basis of the clinical syndrome that some of these patients develop, which is a variety of neurologic deficits, lower extremity weakness, bowel and bladder dysfunction, pain, sometimes neuropathic pain, that has typically been treated by re-exploration of the spine, detethering of the cord again, and reclosure. And my own practice, actually, I work with some of my adult spine colleagues to treat some of those patients in the adult population. And I have to say, our results with that approach over the years has really been disappointing. Some of the patients do get better, but other patients, particularly the patients with pain, get worse. Other patients have new neurologic deficits as a consequence of that re-exploration surgery. So there's been a move towards looking at procedures that reduce the longitudinal tension on the distal cord without actually having to explore the cord. And in this situation, usually what's done is a lower thoracic osteotomy from a posterior approach to reduce, on average, the height of the vertebral column between 1.5 to 2 centimeters. And then a fusion is performed, usually a posterior fusion in the lower thoracic area. And in this group of patients, 41 patients had a secondary tethered cord syndrome, and they were treated with this procedure. 30 had more than 12-month follow-up. So this is one limitation. You know, we really need to have longer follow-up mm-hmm. with these patients. But a couple of points that I pulled out of there was that, it's a patients with a neuropathic pain that often have the least improvement with direct procedure.
Yeah.
Exactly. But this group, 90% at least, reported improvement in pain, which of the group that had that as a presenting symptom. So that's really, really, if that's
huge.
Durable, that's a really promising finding. And then there was a minority that had urodynamics, but there was actually up to 58% had some improvement in urodynamics, which is something we don't usually expect. We expect some stabilization of symptoms, but a lot of patients will often have rarely have improvement. So I think it's not a small procedure, but certainly for a select group of patients, particularly some of these older patients that have persisting symptoms, this is, I think, a viable option that should be presented, and also for the adult population that have delayed deterioration later in life.
Is this got to be one of the larger studies in numbers?
It is. Yeah. It is, definitely.
Well, these were five really great articles. And Nalin, I thank you for presenting these to us here in the AANS podcast. Nalin Gupta, the chief of the Division of Pediatrics at UCSF in neurosurgery and professor of neurosurgery and pediatrics, thank you for sharing your wisdom with us on pediatric articles and for your editorship of JNSP. It's really appreciated.
No problem. Thank you, and it's a pleasure to be here.
Well, thanks for listening to this episode of the AANS podcast. It's not brain surgery, the AANS practice and business management podcast. We'll try and put links in the show notes to these articles so that you can look them up for yourselves. This is Paul Camerata, and we'll talk to you next time.